Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. If you want to check out Author Magazine, you can do so at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the one and only Pacific Northwest Writers Association, which has been supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. Now, if you want to go to a good writers' conference, the PNWA's is one of the best. It's going to be held July 16th to the 19th this year here in the Seattle area. And if you want to connect with agents and editors, if you want to connect with other writers, if you're an indie author and you want to learn how to better connect with your readers, you can find no better place in the Northwest than the PNWA's yearly conference. And if you want to learn about that, you can go to pnwa.org. I should say I am going to be, well, tomorrow night, May 13th, if you're listening to this live, I'm going to be at the East-West Bookstore here in Seattle hosting the Authors Roundtable. Stop on by for that if you want. And this weekend, I will be in Wenatchee at the Right on the River Writers Conference. I'll be teaching a couple classes there, including my author masterclass, the Craft and Confidence Masterclass, on Sunday for the whole conference. So stop on by if you're going to be there. Say hello. I'd love to talk to you. All right. Well, you know, speaking of stories, if you want to tell a story, contrast is always your friend. So if you want to show a story, if you want to tell a story about peace, you must contrast that peace against war. And if you want to write a story about love, you must contrast it against hate. Contrast is how we see what we want to see. And it occurred to me that this is true of culture also. It occurred to me that culture is really a story we're telling ourselves, that a group of people tell themselves about how best to live. And we are often unaware of that culture until it is contrasted against other cultures. And I never would have thought of that until I read Rejane, today's guest, Patricia Parks' debut novel. Fascinating debut novel, highly readable, very funny, very romantic. It's a Korean-American retelling of Emily Bronte's classic Jane Eyre. And Patricia Parks has done a masterful job of it. And she's here with me today to talk about all things writing, culture, and much more, I'm sure. Patricia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And, well, first of all, congratulations. Rejane is out there and it's being well received. How is it going so far?
Thank you. It's been a crazy week, but very exhilarating. And I kind of can't believe that it's finally out there in print.
Finally. Okay, so tell me, was this a long journey from concept to finish to published, or did it happen quickly? What's the story behind the story?
Gosh, Bill, I envy the writer who's an overnight a novelist, or who can bang them out, you know, in a quick turnaround. I guess officially this novel took me 7 years, unofficially 12 years, and
whoa.
I've been writing since I was a little kid. Yeah, so it's definitely a labor of love, forgive the cliche, but it took a long haul.
So 12 years unofficially, 7 years officially. That's so funny.
Yeah.
I know just what you mean, but the idea started bubbling around in your little writer's brain 12 years ago, and you were just a young pup when that happened, probably.
You flatter. Actually, I mean, if we want to really go back, don't they say that every novelist's first novel takes their whole life to write? And so many of my personal experiences are kind of interwoven in this novel. So I think that's kind of, so maybe then that accounts for an even longer timeline.
Yeah. It's so interesting the way these things come together. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the Rejane is a sort of Korean-American retelling of Jane Eyre. And so, but I am guessing, in listening to you now, that it did not begin as that, that maybe it began as more of kind of an autobiographical novel, or is that,
yeah,
or did it really
yeah,
come to
you? Yeah, your hunch is right.
As,
that, Yeah, that's exactly what it was. In high school and college, I wrote a lot of poetry, and suddenly I was taking on family themes in my poems, and the poems would go from tight little, lines of verse into sprawling prose poems, and finally I just had to ditch the poetic genre and form, and I told myself, look, I really have a novel here on my hands, and I need to work this material into that form.
But when was the idea to give it the structure of Jane Eyre? Because that's a very particular idea.
Yeah, well, to back up, when I was little and I used to misbehave, my mother would always say to me in her broken English, she's a Korean immigrant, and she would say, "You act like orphan." And that never made sense to me, because you either are one or you aren't. And I realized that her definition of orphan meant to act in a shameful way that disgraced your family. And I first read Jane Eyre when I was 12, and I was really struck by these epithets that were thrown at Jane. You know, she was friendless, wicked, mischievous. And then, that was just kind of brewing. And then in grad school, I read Jane Eyre again, and I realized that those very epithets reflected the Victorian construct of the orphan. And my mind kind of drew a link between the Korean post-war orphan and the Victorian one. And I think that was officially how Reed Jane was born.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I was talking to my wife about it, she was asking me, she saw me reading and said, "What's this all about?" And I started explaining it, and it occurred to me as I was explaining it how perfect, what a nice fit it was, because, of course, the Victorian time had all these very strict social structures. And the culture you describe, the Korean culture you describe, also has a lot of, compared to what we think of in the West, where things are kind of loosey-goosey, compared to what the Korean, even the Korean-American, it's a much more structured, the higher expectation that almost reminds me of the West during Victorian times, at least culturally. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that was what drew me. I think continually my mind was drawing these parallels between the world that I grew up in, which was of Korean immigrants in Queens, New York, and then I would turn to the Victorian novels as kind of my literary heroes. So the novel was, Reed Jane was definitely speaking to these two cultural influences. And as for the societies themselves, I mean, Korean society is very much coded with it's hierarchical. There are expectations for each person and how they should kind of function in a way in that society. And there are all these codes of behavior that are unspoken. And you really have to read between the lines, as I imagine the Victorians did in their parlors and their billiards rooms.
Well, you know, one of my best friends growing up in high school, and still one of my closest friends, is Korean American, and he described the Korean weddings. His description of them was mind-boggling to me, because he got married in Korea. And essentially, everybody who has ever known you or known of you shows up at this wedding, to the tune of thousands sometimes, just to stop by and make an appearance, which made no sense to me, but said, yes, that's how it has to be done. Are you familiar with that particular ritual?
There's a lot of that. It's maybe one word for it, there's a Korean word, chaemyeon, and it's kind of like saving face, or you are expected to put in your face time. From my understanding, Korean weddings are a whole larger affair, and they're slotted in, I think, one-hour increments at the catering halls. So talk about like a scripted ceremony. I know my brother had a very trim wedding of 340 people, and he was fighting with my parents to trim down that list. But of course, if you can't not invite this person, because then it reflects badly on that person, and then everyone seems to be related to everyone else, so it's a whole big to do.
Well, absolutely, and you mentioned reading between the lines, and one of my favorite, I guess you can call it words, but really it's a concept, which is nunchi. Is that pronounced correct? Nunchi? Nunchi?
Yeah. You must be Korean, because your pronunciation is spot on.
Ah, good. So my friend Peter, who I've known since I was 14, has never told me about nunchi, and I'm going to have to scold him for that. But so tell our listeners who are not themselves, who don't speak Korean, what this is and how important it is into this story, even.
Yeah, there's no equivalent for it in English, but it's nunchi is this ability to walk into a room, read the situation, and anticipate how you're supposed to behave as well as everyone else. So it could be something as simple as knowing to pour your elder's water glass before you pour your own, you know, giving up your seat without even having to be asked to give up your seat. One of my favorite characters from Ray Jane is a woman named Eunice, who's a total sci-fi geek. She went to MIT, and she likens Nunchi, Eye of Sauron, which is this kind of all-knowing stink eye that just goes deet, 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 you know, roving about to catch your every social misstep. Maybe the academics might call it like a Foucauldian panopticon, you know, where you're under surveillance, and yeah, it's almost kind of punitive in a way. I mean, bear in mind, Bill, this is my Korean-American take on a Korean concept, but this has been a kind of guiding force through much of my life.
Sure. You know what it reminds me of? When I talk to you about this, and I don't want to go on and on about, because there's a lot more to it, but when I talked to Ayad Akhtar, who won the Pulitzer for Disgrace, the Pulitzer Prize for the play Disgrace, and so he's a Muslim American, so he had to deal with culture and religion and all that. And one thing he and I got to talking about, and it reminds me, I think of it now as I'm talking to you, is the artist, which is really, I think of what James Joyce said about the artist. And what he said was, and see if this resonates with you, he said, my allegiance is to myself, to my voice, to my vision. And any family, religion, country, relationship, anything that doesn't serve it's got to go. That was his take. And I do think that the artist is up against the driving force of whatever culture they come from to say, I love you, I know it, and yet I must speak what I know to speak, even if it's in contrast to what I've been told I should speak. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, well, the other flip side to that expression is write like an orphan, you know? So,
yeah, yeah.
And I think there is a bit of selfishness that happens. I mean, whether it's kind of the Virginia Woolf version of carving, you know, having a room of your own and carving out a physical space which you devote solely to writing, or carving out the time. For me, you know, I grew up, I was born and raised in New York City, and when I first started writing this novel, I moved away for 5 years. Writing this, and I think at least some of that time away, I was freed of all of those obligations of birthdays and weddings and you know, christenings and whatever else, which was unfortunate that I missed out on a lot of that family, the family stuff. But it just on a day-to-day basis freed up more time, and psychologically too, I feel like you cannot get perspective on a community. Whether it's your own family or your larger ethnic community or cultural community, until you're away from it. Otherwise, you just feel too beholden to not air out, you know, to not show an honest portrait, because you're trying to, again, save face or maybe present the best image.
Yeah, because writing is such an inside-out experience, and I have found, and I teach this religiously to my students, that you cannot write authentically until you stop thinking about other people. You just can't, because they're not there. And so you're writing to a non-entity, that you're the only one there, and your preferences and your loves and your desires and your curiosity is what you have to be, what you're beholden to. And you've got to retreat mentally from the idea of other people, because they can't help you. They can only interfere, I think.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard it put exactly that way, but I think that really resonates. I'm going to have to adopt that as my new mantra.
Well, you know, it's really true, because I'm like a lot of people. I teach a lot of my students are women, and they have a hard time overcoming this need to sort of look out for other people and please other people and take care of other people. And writing's got nothing to do with that. You got to forget about all those other people. And I got to go through it too when I write.
Yeah, and I think for women especially, there is such an expectation that they perform the role of care, and that they're always putting their personal they have to put their personal needs aside for their family, their friends, for their loved ones. Forgive me if I'm misremembering, but I think Ilette Waldman, who is Michael Chabon's wife, you know, wrote a rather groundbreaking, or maybe a bit of a controversial essay where. You know, she talks about some of these expectations and even that she, I think that she loves her husband more than her children, and just what it means to be a female writer who's a mother, a wife, and has to play to all of these other roles.
You have to be able to, you know, the room of one's own thing is legit. It's true for everybody, in that when you close the door to your workroom, you have to be able to shut out everyone. You have to shut out your kids. You've got to shut out your loved ones. You can't be worrying about them, thinking about them. It has to be you and your work. It's not easy for all of us to do, but that's the only way to do it. That's the only way to connect. I can't think of how to do it and worry about them at the same time. And I have kids, and I've got a wife, and the whole blah, blah, blah. But you have to shut them out. You got to shut them out. You love them, but you've got to shut them out.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you have kids while you started writing this, or do you have kids?
No, I do not, no.
Well, it does make it easier. But doesn't matter. You have a life to lead. Okay, so you've written this book. It's out. Was it a struggle to get it, to find a publisher for it? Was that a torturous journey, or did it go relatively smoothly for you?
No, I mean, that part wasn't as torturous as just the writing part. I mean, at least when you have it out to publishers, you're getting some feedback. Something that you've created is, there's a response to it, whether it's a yay or a nay. But I think the hardest part in all of this was just forcing myself to keep working on it and to not just chuck it aside and say, you know what, I'm just going to live my life and not have this thing hanging over me. And it's very frustrating because all around you, you see, you know, I saw my colleagues and friends and family getting promotions, you know, getting married, building a life in all the conventional ways that we think right. about. And for me, you know, my achievements were all small and in my head. It was like,
right.
yes, you know, I nailed the I finally figured out that Eunice Oh was a Core 6 major at MIT, and, you know, she carries around a computer programming textbook instead of a TI-83 calculator. Like, these are really small achievements that don't mean anything to anyone else, yet they are your world as a writer. And unfortunately, yeah, you don't have much concrete to show for it until it's a finished product and it's out with a publisher, or that just that it takes physical form as a book.
That is so well put, Patricia, and it is so the challenge for so many writers, because when you decide to write, it's not like getting a law degree where you've got something lined up. You have nothing lined up for you usually. Nothing.
Exactly. And I mean, with those kinds of, professional degrees, you're building your human capital. You have that degree signals to the rest of society, hey, I have these skills. I am immediately hireable, though, you know, maybe the not so much with our economy these days, but whereas with writing, you put in 1 year, you put in 7, to the average person, it looks like you have nothing to show for it.
That's right. It is such a... you really have to get comfortable with forgetting about goals in a certain way, or outcomes. Stop thinking about outcomes. The outcomes, you know, if you can think of it one word at a time, you'll feel successful. But when you start demanding outcomes, you'll blow your mind away. At least it does to me. I have to pull it back to the smallest little measurables, or I just think it's all go for naught.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I found hugely helpful in the writing process was running and long distance running. When I first started, when I officially first started this novel, I ran the New York City Marathon, and that was my
Ooh.
First. And as you say, these small goals, right? If you think about, oh my gosh, I'm going to go out and bang out 26.2 miles, you'll never do it. But you have to keep telling yourself, I will run to that next stop sign. I will run to that
right,
person holding
right.
the, you know, the run for beer sign. You know,
right.
I'll run to the next mile. So you just, it's almost like you can only flash the flashlight in the dark only a few feet ahead of you, and not to project too far out, or else you'll just get discouraged and you won't complete it.
Oh, that is good. The marathon is the perfect. I was a runner. Very competitive runner, like in high school and starting in college. But I was a sprinter.
Oh, you were one of those. Yeah.
Yes. So, and I do like the short format sometimes, I found, lo and behold. But I would say the book length is absolutely a marathon. You've got to just hunker down and not even think about the finish line.
Yeah, and you can't cram for a marathon just the way you cannot cram for a novel. I mean, a 5K, 10K, you know, maybe even a half marathon, you could kind of just bang it out. You'll be paying for it after you cross the finish line, but I feel that it's doable, whereas a marathon, you just can't fake it. So it requires a certain amount of training and endurance that you know, I did my own slapdash version of it, of the marathon the first, you know, the first time around. So I definitely have lessons to learn if I run another one.
My word. Well, I hope you survive. Oh, I have a guest online who wants to ask you a question, Patricia. Let's let's get him. I think I know who it is. Jeff, how is that you?
It is. It is I, Bill. How are you?
I'm fabulous.
Another wonderful, wonderful interview. Patricia,
thanks.
Congratulations. Firstly, I want to wish you on parallel success with your debut novel, Re-Jane.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Person who's listening right now as I speak, and she sends her, well, you're obviously an accomplished writer, but I'm always fascinated about not just the process, but going through the process. So my question to you, what would you say, Pat, would be the nadir and the zenith, the high and the low point of writing this book, of course, notwithstanding publishing Re-Jane?
Good question.
The high point was being able to point to my name printed on the jacket and finally showing it to my parents and being like, this is what I've been doing for the better part of a decade that you people did not understand. No, it's not nice to call your parents you people. The low point was I was on a Fulbright to research this novel in Korea because a third of it takes place there. And I was quite depressed when I was there. It was a culture that was so foreign to me, despite the fact that I grew up in an ethnic Korean community in Queens, New York. So I thought I knew it, and I just I felt that I could never fit in. You know, I could not master the walking of the walk or talking the talk. And that was a point where I kind of hit a rut in the novel as well. So those two things are conflated, and it just made me question everything about how I did things before, because I would say things and then all of a sudden people would look aghast and I realized I'd inadvertently offended people in my botched version of their native tongue. Looking back on it now, though, I don't know, maybe I had to go through some of those low points in order to bring those experiences to Re-Jane and to see, to imagine how Jane might experience some of them too in moving from one culture to another.
Well, I was going to say, listening to you describe your experience, all I can think about is Jane's experience that as you described it. While it was painful for you, it was great for the material because you were able to translate it right to her.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jane got off a little much easier than I did. Yeah, I mean, in Korea, at least, you know, for me, in Korea, in Seoul, my experience was that there was this expectation for women to be hyper feminine. You know, I wore jeans and sneakers. I did not wear makeup. And, you know, I'd walk into a shop, shopkeepers would kind of turn their noses. You know, taxi drivers would make comments. Even my teachers would be, you know, they'd make little polite suggestions and they'd say, you know, maybe you should think about wearing makeup. And my family in Korea, too, you know, I'd wear flip-flops and I'd get a lot of flack for it. So just little things like that, superficial things that you think should not bother you. You think, oh, you know, I'm an adult. I've gotten an education. I'm grounded in myself. But it's especially as a woman, you forget that little comments like that that add up during the course of the day. It makes you question who you are and question your own self-worth and, you know, maybe even make you think twice before you step outside and face the light of day.
Oh, no, it would be nice if it was limited to women, but speaking from the other gender, I can assure you those experiences can be quite just devastating. They don't have to be, but it is so hard for me to keep my attention out of other people's heads. If they're looking at me, mentioning things about me, oh, it can be debilitating. You know, it's debilitating because it makes you question yourself. It doesn't make you but you begin to question yourself. And it's so hard to live if you question yourself. Does that make sense? I mean, you're your own guide. And if you're questioning it, how do you live from the inside?
Exactly.
Out?
Yeah. And well, one of the wonderful things about Jane Eyre is that, you know, she self-describes as poor, obscure, plain, and little. She grew up in an environment where everyone was telling her those very you know, describing her by those very four adjectives. And yet, I'm, you know, she still emerges with like a strong sense of self and an unshakable independence. And, you know, if someone like Jane Eyre, who is in every way marginalized in that society, can succeed, then I guess there's hope for us all.
Of course. Of course there is. My God, you know, it. When I have seen people transform remarkably when they tap into their inner genius that I absolutely believe exists in everyone, but the only way to do it is to stop listening to what everybody tells you you should be. They don't know. You know, think about this, Patricia. No one can write your book for you because only you knew that book. Everybody could talk and talk and talk about what they think it should be, but in the end, it's in you and no one can see it. That's where the genius is. No one can touch it. No one can smell it. No one can read it until it comes out of you. The genius is in there, and anyone can do it. Absolutely anyone.
Yeah. Well, what's tough there is, you know, especially for young and emerging writers, you want to follow kind of the tutelage of your mentors or your instructors or your peers. And it's hard to know what your own, as you put, inner genius is. It's hard to know which voice to follow when you're hearing all the chorus.
I'll tell you what it is. You ready? I'm going to give you,
okay.
Here, this is
my
quick class.
Voice.
Got you right. Let's write it down. No, but this is true. The effortless path is your path. The effortless path. Writing is a search for effortlessness. And the one that is the most effortless, that's how you find the right word, is the effortless word, the word that fits in effortlessly, not the one you have to force in and make the character do this. Ah, so you knew that Eunice had that book. Why? It felt effortless. It felt right. That's the effortless path. That's the path of genius. And when you're trying to live for someone else, you're working against the current of your own desires. That's how you know the most effortless path. And that's everyone's journey anyway, Patricia, not just the writers, but it's everyone's. But that's what you're looking for, that effortless journey. And then it'll be, when you hit it, it's sweet.
Yeah, it's
sweet,
that
sweet
spot, right? Like when you hit the golf ball right in that right spot and it feels,
that's right.
You feel airless.
That's right. No resistance. It just, whoosh, that's what you're looking for. That's what you're looking for. And we keep looking for it. You know, you don't find it once. You have to find it again and again and again. So, well, listen, this has been a fabulous conversation. And I hope you've got more, because I don't want to tell our readers this is a really readable book. It's a lot of fun. It's engaging. You won't be able to put it down. So do go and pick it up. I highly recommend it. And I hope there's others coming from you, Patricia. Are there?
I'm working on my second book, and it takes a minor character from Ree Jane and imagines things from his point of view, and it's about the Korean community in Buenos Aires, Argentina. So please keep your fingers crossed on me as I continue on with that with that journey.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Okay, well, so we still have time for you to answer my favorite question. It's my final question, and what I want you to do is finish this sentence for me. All right.
Okay.
And this is the sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
How to get in the heads of other people.
Oh, how to get in the heads of other people. And how has it taught you that, besides the obvious
ways? Well, I mean, because it's so easy for us to pass judgment very quickly. You know, we size up a situation. We're like, why did someone do that? They're so stupid. But as a novelist, you have to take unlikable characters and find a way to make them sympathetic sometimes, and which means looking at things from their perspective and looking at their questionable actions and trying to understand why, what would motivate them to do it. So I think that's what writing has taught me, or is continuing to teach me.
You know what that's called? That's called compassion, Patricia.
It's teaching you. I guess it is.
It's called compassion, baby. That's what it is.
Yeah, or telepathy. No, I like compassion better.
There you go. Well, Patricia, I wish you the best of luck with this. I hope you have a lot of fun on your book tour, and I hope you sell a bazillion books.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. It was such a pleasure talking with you today.
All right. Thank you. Good luck. Compassion, everybody. It's true. Got to be compassionate. It's where we all land. Writing is about understanding the world, even though it comes from you, It is actually about understanding the world beyond you. It's quite magical that way. All right, well, listen, folks, I'm not going to be here next week. I'm going to be teaching a class down in Squim. But I will be back the next week talking to Amit Goswami about quantum economics. Whew, should be fun. Until then, I want you to go out and be kind to people and find something you love and do it again and again and again.